My name is Erica Valenciana, and one of my favorite things is making my own clothes.
Welcome to the Finding Favorites podcast, where we explore your favorite things without using an algorithm. Here's your host, Leah Jones.
Hello, and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones. If this is your first time to the podcast, because you are coming to listen to my guest host, Amy Guth, interview Erica Valenciana, welcome. I'm so glad you're here. Amy is filling in for me. This is her second interview this month. She has been filling in because this is the last month that I am getting chemotherapy for stage one breast cancer. And while I'm recording this on what I lovingly call Steroid Saturday, by tomorrow I will be deep in nap country. And I found out that I couldn't keep up with the podcast. So Amy and Shai Corman each picked up two episodes this month, and I'm grateful to their help. So Amy is interviewing filmmaker Erica Valenciana, whose new documentary, La Mitad del Mundo, is going to premiere at Lit Luz in March in Mexico City. So stick around, and I'm so happy that you are here for that interview. If you are looking for updates on how I'm doing, I have been continuing, despite the cough, continuing to dodge COVID, in large part due to my homebody-ness. I just stay home. And my friends who come visit, now that there's a little bit more accessibility to rapid tests, my friends have been getting negative tests before they come over. I double mask at the infusion center. And so I have just been very lucky. And my friends have been, because Omicron, the rules of COVID changed and it was hard to know how to be safe. So it's not a moral judgment on anyone who has caught COVID recently, because Omicron is spreading so fast. And I am in a position of privilege to be able to stay home and afford rapid tests. And I'm aware of that. Next week is my final chemo infusion. I'm trying to decide how much to, like, I have my glitter dress from that I wore at Hanukkah, my caftan that I've been thinking about wearing to my final chemo. But then I'm also worried about jinxing things, because the following week I have CAT scan, brain MRI, I see a pulmonologist, I do a radiology intake, and we make the plans for what comes next. And so I will be doing certainly some light celebration about the end of chemotherapy, but I'm trying to decide how to temper it, how to not to jinx myself by being too excited that things are over. But I am very excited that the chemotherapy will be over. You know, I will have a month of radiation. With it, I expect incredible fatigue. And then I will continue my antibody treatment, Herceptin, through the end of the year, every 3 weeks. So it's like a much more chill medicine. It's still an infusion, so I'll still be going into the infusion center every 3 weeks until November. So that is what's up with me in the kind of this area of breast cancer I'm in. And I think that's all I've got this morning. I'm so happy you're here, and enjoy this conversation between Amy Guth and filmmaker Erica Valenciana. And wear your mask, wash your hands, get your booster, and keep enjoying your favorite things.
I'm Amy Guth, in for Leah Jones, and I'm here today with Erica Valenciana, who is a filmmaker and Chicago native. And she's done a lot in the film world, which we're going to talk about here in a bit, but she's also unbelievably creative in so many ways, which I think we'll also talk about. Erica, welcome.
Thank you, Amy, and thanks for the lovely introduction.
Well, I feel like I could go on at length about your bio, because you've done so many things, so I figured we would just talk about those things. What was your foray into filmmaking? What was the first thing that you did?
Oh, okay, well, if we're going to talk about the first thing, we're going to have to go way, way back. So imagine me as an eight-year-old, had very long hair down my back that was always in a giant braid. And my brother actually asked me if I could run the camera while we sort of did a, I don't know if you could call it a parody of Cops. So yeah, so we would like take my dad's giant VHS camera, and that we actually, I don't think we had permission to use it. So I'm sure we were using it without him knowing. And so I was the camera person part of the time, and part of the time I was a Coke dealer.
At eight.
Which was obviously a very age appropriate role for me. And I don't even think I really knew what Coke was, but he had me like, you know, put some like sugar on my nose, and I was holding a mirror, and I knew it was something drug related, but I didn't totally understand it. But yeah, so it was like him and my little brother were like the cops. And then there was a chase. And then at the end, like I jumped off a building, and just looking back on it, he had an interesting choice to then point the camera down over the balcony where we're filming. And of course I wasn't there. So I don't know why he opted to like, you know, show that part of it. And then the best part was probably how you know, it was all in camera editing. And when we're walking back into the house, you can see the reflection in the door. And so it's like them two who are supposed to be there, and then me behind them, and then our little, like, I guess, you know, she would have been like very, very young, my like 2-year-old sister at the time, kind of trailing behind us in like her diaper, like just watching us film this thing. So I would say that's like my earliest memory of filmmaking. And then later on, it was, you know, like teachers who would let me submit a video instead of a book report kind of thing. And me at the time definitely thinking they were suckers and that I was getting away with something, not realizing that that was like a very intentional pedagogical move on their behalf. But yeah, so that was like super early stuff. And then I took, they called it broadcasting class in high school, so did weird videos in high school. But I would say like filmmaking for me has always, like, I always knew that's what I was going to do. And it's hard for me to explain that, but like, I would watch movies and I would think like, oh, I have no idea how this is done, but I will do that. Like, that is what I'm going to do. And then later on, I'll learn how to do it, you know? So I never, you know, like I always knew that was going to be my major, like throughout high school, when I had classmates that were like freaking out about like, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? You know, and like, how do you know? And I was just like, I don't know. That's just what I'm going to do. And that's what I'm doing. So really the journey was more like specifically, because there's so many aspects to filming, is like what specifically to do. And I feel like I'm still figuring that out, you know, because I started film school and, you know, I thought I was going to make fiction films and, you know, do stop motion animation on the side. And then I took a documentary class and my life just took a different direction. But I feel like now I'm sort of, you know, like I never stopped coming up with stories. And it was like this faucet that I'd kind of like shut off, because I was like, no, like, I don't, you know, I have more important things to do. And now I'm making documentaries and that's important. And I don't have time to make up my weirdo stories. But it was like, you know, the pressure was building. And finally it was like, oh no, I have to go back to doing fiction stuff. So, you know, trying to balance that out with my documentary work now.
That's interesting. I've never asked you that specifically of like, how did it start? And how did you know? That was going to be my next question of when you decided to make a career of it, but that was decided. You knew all along.
Yeah. I feel it almost like it doesn't even feel like a decision. It's just like this knowledge that I always had that that's what I will be doing. It never felt like a choice. I think, you know, entertaining a few other ideas at certain points, because, you know, that's kind of what you're expected to do. You're not expected to just like, no, this is it, no choice kind of thing, because obviously I had a choice, right? And so like I got really into photography, but that obviously really lends itself to filmmaking, you know, image making. And there were other things that I was kind of like, oh, maybe I should do that. But there was never anything that I wanted to do more than filmmaking. And even at points when it's been like really hard to make a living from it, I still like, I can't think of anything else I want to do more than filmmaking. So
it's like, you can't not.
Exactly. Exactly. And I have like, I mean, you know me, like I have too many interests, like more than I have time to cultivate, pursue. But yeah, there's just like every time I think of like, oh, maybe I should go into this, I'm like, no, but I still want to be a filmmaker before that. So yeah, it's still feeling like I don't have the choice, you know?
And then talk to me a little bit about the role of fellowships, because I feel like you've done a ton of fellowships and gotten lots of grants. You had Kartemquin's Diverse Voices. the Emerging Storyteller Grant, Tribeca Film Institute, Stowe Story Labs. Like, you've really done a lot of those. What is the role of all those in your career, do you feel?
It's cultivating my skills and sort of building community, you know, like meeting a lot of other people in the program. That's such a like huge part of it for me. And I think, you know, like a lot of those programs. So for example, the Diverse Voices and Docs with Carr Tempwin, I feel like I was kind of like stalled for a little bit. And I think I was just kind of like overwhelmed by like exactly how I could pursue filmmaking as a career. And what I feel like that program did for me was it really kind of like jump started it again, or it kind of like made the path a little clearer for me. And then that's sort of when I really started, you know, I was like, okay, well, writing grants is part of it, so I got to do that. And then I just kept doing it until I got a grant, and then just kept doing it until I got better at it and was getting grants more often than I wasn't. So that's what that program did for me. But I feel like each program, each fellowship kind of has its own, you know, has helped me in different ways. Like with the Stowe Story Labs, like I love them so much. And what that did for me is, you know, like I was talking about my change from like I was exclusively doing documentary and then kind of coming back to fiction filmmaking. And it does feel like, I'm sure there's some sort of like unconscious connection to all the different themes of, you know, both my documentary and fiction. But in my mind, like I don't really see that connection. Like my fiction films tend to be like a lot more like wackier, you know, sort of like things from my imagination, like a lot of animation, that kind of thing. But I guess my documentaries also have my animation in it. So they feel like very separate, and it's trying to find how they're connected. But because I had done documentary for so long, I didn't feel like a, you know, like a writer anymore. I didn't feel like a screenwriter anymore. And it just gave me my agency to call myself a screenwriter again. Cause like you go there and it doesn't matter how many scripts you've written, like they just address you as like you screenwriters, you know? And so I felt like it helped me take myself seriously as a writer. And like I had written a feature script, and that's what made me a screenwriter. And I think, you know, I've had that at other points in my life too, where it's like, can I call myself a filmmaker if that's not how I'm making my living right now? And of course, you know, that's the imposter syndrome coming in, right? But, you know, I've learned that, no, if I make films, then I'm a filmmaker. And yes, sometimes I will make my living from it and sometimes I won't, but it doesn't make me any less of a filmmaker. There's plenty of people who call themselves filmmakers who have way less experience than I do or did at that time when I was having those thoughts. And, you know, they have no problem with it. So I think it helps. These programs will, you know, a lot of times it is kind of legitimizing you in the eyes of other people as well. You know, they're definitely resume builders. That's part of it. But I always get something out of them, you know, like it's more than that for me, I should say. Like, you know, it might be that for like the people looking at my resume, but for me, it's, you know, making these friendships with people I would have never, you know, people from across the globe. I would have never met these people in Scotland or Mexico City or, you know, wherever. And all of a sudden they're my friends and we're collaborating or we're sharing each other's work. We're giving each other feedback. And, you know, filmmaking is a relationship-based industry. So that kind of thing is so important. For me, the benefits are, yeah, the relationships, and there's always some kind of skill building part of it too. That's always, you're always learning something new. And I think for me, it's always so important to keep learning all the time. Like I've always been a person who takes classes and has never stopped taking classes. And so that's something I'm going to keep doing, is just building my skills. And yeah. And sometimes it's funny because I'll take classes at Columbia College, which is where I graduated from. And, you know, I go in there and I'm definitely always like the oldest person there, you know, like closer in age to the instructor than the students. And I always have this like kind of like when I walk in moment, like this back to school moment, you know, like Rodney Dangerfield and like, hey, can I get some respect kind of thing? But everyone's always very lovely. And, you know, no one's ever like, oh my God, you're not a millennial, but they're not even millennials anymore. They're like, whatever the term is now for them.
The Gen Zs.
Yeah, they're Gen Zers now. So yeah, but nobody ever treats me differently for being the old lady and the thing. But I think there should be other people my age in that class. I doubt everybody already knows everything they should know about whatever, you know, it is.
Well, you touched on something I think is really interesting that I think a lot of creative people struggle with of that calling yourself a filmmaker, calling yourself a writer. You know, I feel like I'm always running into people of all kinds of creative disciplines. They're like, well, I want to be a writer. Oh, okay. Well, you need to start writing. Oh no, I write every day. So you mean published, like you mean published and getting paid. And then sometimes you find people that are like, I want to be a writer. They've published 3 books and they're just not making a living at it. Well, like you're a writer, you're doing it. Same kind of thing. But I think we kind of struggle with this idea of self-certifying, of giving ourselves permission to be that thing.
Yeah, definitely. I do feel women and people of color, like it even more so, you know, and it's this idea of like, am I legitimate? Does my work have value? And yeah, it's like, what is the thing that sort of makes you that role? So I rewatched the movie. What is it? I forgot the incredible Jessica James. I think it's like a movie with Jessica Williams where she plays this, it's this really funny character that actually totally reminds me of my sister, but she's a playwright. And so she collects her rejection letters, which I thought was awesome. I was like, man, I wish I collected my rejection letters. You know, she talks to the person who she sort of wants to become, like the, you know, and the woman asked her, she's like, no, she asked the woman, she's like, oh, like, when do you know that you're a playwright? Or, you know, I'm paraphrasing. And she's like, well, this is it. You're doing it. Like, what do you think? I take the train just like anyone else. And then she's like, asked her something about like, oh, was, you don't think it's like when you get a yacht, or I forgot exactly how it went, but she's like, how much do you think playwrights make? You know, and so it is this idea, like, even when you're quote unquote successful, maybe you're still not going to make that much money. You know, like the people I want to be now, like a lot of them have day jobs, you know? So yeah, that is really interesting to me. So like imposter syndrome was something I really struggled with before, and I do not anymore. You know, it's just like a non-issue for me. And I try to transfer that to other people because I know it's such a big thing that a lot of really incredible artists that I know struggle with. And I just feel like it's such a shame and such a waste of brain space, you know? So I wish I had never struggled with it, but yeah, now I'm good. I'm just like, whatever, if that's how I make my money, cool, like even better. But if it's not, it doesn't mean I'm making any less projects.
Well, let's talk about some of those projects. I know about one in particular that I'm involved with, but talk us through for those who may not be familiar with your projects.
Sure. So the project you're referring to is La Mitad del Mundo, which you helped me produce, which is a short documentary that shares the lives of young survivors of sex trafficking in Ecuador. And it does it through live action and stop motion animation. So that was a project that took me a really long time to make, you know, in part because of the imposter syndrome that I was talking about, and in part because it was just such a difficult subject matter. You know, I would go and film and I'd come back and I wanted nothing to do with the footage because it was traumatic enough to sort of experience that, you know, the interview firsthand, that I didn't want to like rewatch it. And that's when I learned that, you know, it's really important to have an editor, and like, you can't do it all yourself and you shouldn't try, really. So that's when I met my incredible editor, Magdalena Hernandez, who like is editing other projects of mine now. And I think after that experience, what I realized was that you really have to be careful with how you choose your subject matter with your projects, because, you know, I picked it because I said, this is really, really important. And, you know, we need to hear more about it, and not enough people know about it, and they need to know more about it and all that stuff. And that's great. But, you know, that was just really, really tough. And I just wouldn't choose my subject matter lightly anymore. You know, I definitely think like, how am I going to cope with this? What is going to be that sort of like self-care that happens while I'm filming that? And, you know, those were not my considerations at all when I chose that. So I'm glad that I did it, but yeah, I, you know, moving forward, it's a little bit different. And so that project is completed now, and it's going to be premiering at the Lit and Loose Film Festival in Mexico City in March, which I'm super stoked about because it's also my birthday week. So that'll be fun. And then, you know, the projects I have going on right now, I have 2 short docs. So one of them is a poetic documentary about women brewers. It's me and my producer, Anu Rana, we're going to do some exploration during the editing process, exactly what it's going to look like. But a lot of it is going to, there's this film called Glass. I'm totally pronouncing it wrong because it's Scandinavian. It's like Gloss, probably. But and so it's kind of showing the process of brewing, but showing women doing it. And that kind of came about because I had, so my brother, he works in the beer industry, and you know, I made a lot of friends through him, a lot of female brewers and other parts of the of brewing. And I would hear these stories, like all these stories about sexism in the industry. And they always felt very like isolated one-off stories, like, oh, those guys specifically are jerks, you know, or what's that guy's problem or whatever. And then I remember reading an article, and it had kind of, and there were a bunch of different articles like this. It was just the first one I had read, and they kind of compiled the stories. And I remember reading, as I was reading, one of the stories was actually something that had happened to a friend of mine, and I was there for it or around it, near it. And then that's kind of when I realized, like, oh no, this is like, this is a problem in the industry and really in all sort of male dominant industries, right? Because a lot of these experiences sounded really similar to what was going on with filmmaking too. Like I remember a bunch of even classes that I had in film school where, or even in high school, like my filmmaking classes were all boys. So, you know, a lot of like challenges. And then, you know, at the time you're kind of thinking like, no, I'm tough, I can get through this. And, you know, but later on in retrospect, you're kind of like, I shouldn't have to get through it. You know, this shouldn't be things that I'm putting up with. So yeah, that article kind of helped me realize like, oh no, like I want to show, because I think the biggest thing was, as part of the stories were people, and it wasn't just men, it was other women sometimes too, like kind of doubting them that they were capable of doing the job. You know, you're not using your genitalia to brew the beer. So like, why is that?
Let's hope not anyway.
Yeah, you shouldn't be. Yeah. So it's like, why does this, you know, and yeah, it takes more than just strength to be a brewer. And then like kind of in doing the research, realizing that throughout history, women were the brewers until it was industrialized, until it was commodified. And then all of a sudden, when there's money to be made, then all of a sudden it became man's work, but it used to be called ladies' work. And then, you know, all the imagery of witches probably came from women brewers, you know, like the pointy hats, the cats in the, you know, like the witch's brew was probably beer brew, you know, and the broom was like a sign to show that a brew was ready so you can come in and buy some. So, you know, it's interesting how like the female aspects of it kind of became like negative or, you know, so yeah, so that's one of my short projects. And then I have another short documentary called Brewer by the Lake, which I'm making with my good friend Mitch Wenkis, and he's shooting it, and the awesome Magdalena is editing it. And it's cool because we finally have like a work sample, so there's finally something sort of tangible to show for that one, because I've been chipping away at that one for a long time as well. And that one is about urban bird conservation in Chicago, and most of it is going to be kind of like lighthearted in tone, because, you know, birders are characters and I love characters. I am a character. So I'm drawn to other quirky people like myself. So yeah, but kind of showing little ways that you can sort of help the birds in your life, you know, showing the ways through birders and the work that they do. So that'll be like another cute short film, hopefully. And then my sort of bigger project that I'm developing is my script called The Punk Show in Chicago, which is about two Mexican-American best friends who travel from Kansas City to Chicago to go to a punk rock show, but also one of them needs to get an abortion. And Chicago is kind of like an abortion oasis in the Midwest. And so partially telling that story, but this film is a comedy. So it's like, I was inspired by a lot of things really, and I'm kind of throwing in all the different things that I'm missing from other films into this project. But I watch Planes, Trains, and Automobiles like regularly, you know, and like I always wanted a road trip comedy. I always wanted to make that, you know, and thinking about growing up in this whole time that I'm, you know, in my head, I'm already like a filmmaker, like that's what I'm going to be, right? But when I'm watching films, I don't see anybody who looks like me. I'm very rarely seeing like experiences that reflect my own. And so that's like a big part of it for me in telling this story is representation. And what's that quote? Like, if you can't, you can't be it if you can't see it, you know, kind of thing, and showing that. And so I just want to make a really funny story with some magical realism and talking vans and yeah, but also have these other little things that I think we need to talk about. And I guess that's where my documentary work is sort of informing my fiction work now, after having made documentaries for so long. But it's still, you know, this weird story about weird people, and hopefully it'll be really funny.
Well, I mean, you say weird stories about weird people, but really, like, I feel like a theme that goes through all your work is about underrepresented voices, even underrepresented birds, right? Even like underrepresented needs of the birds in an urban environment. I feel like that's a theme that just reverberates through all of your work so much.
Yeah, you know, there you go. I just needed you to kind of like repeat all my stuff to you. And then you kind of, yeah, it's funny because I remember the place at Columbia where you take all your documentary classes. It used to be a little more formalized space where you could like check out your equipment, and like there was like the Doc Club, the Viva Doc Club and stuff. And it's called the Michael Rabiger Center for Documentary. And so on occasion, our teacher would have him like sub for us. And I remember one time he came in and he was like asking people about their work. And then he would kind of repeat back to them like what the theme was of their work. And I was like, oh, I can't wait to tell him mine. He's not going to find any connection whatsoever, you know, and kind of like, you know, listed all the weird characters I had and all the weird movies that I had in my mind and was making and whatnot. And he's like, oh yeah, you know, like your theme is like kind of like outsiders and people. And I was like, oh, he just like nailed it. He went straight to the heart. I was like, I thought I was going to trick him, but obviously he knows way better than I do as a 20 something year old. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's things that connect it, but yeah, it does, maybe on the surface, they feel very different, but I'm there, you know, in all of it.
All right. Well, Erica, what is the favorite thing that we're here to talk about today?
Oh, okay. I would say that it's hard for me to say anything is my favorite because it feels like a Sophie's choice, you know, like you're asking me to make that choice and I feel like you don't have to make me make that choice.
Right.
but yeah, something else that I'm really into, I would say, is I enjoy sewing, although I don't have as much time for it now as I used to. And one big thing that I'm sure I'll eventually make a film about as well is kind of pushing back against fast fashion. And the slowest fashion you can have really is making your own clothes. And it's a good thing. It's like a skill that I've chosen to cultivate because I feel like it's the best pushback against it, you know, partially because filmmakers don't make a lot of money and I can't buy super expensive handmade clothes by someone else. But yeah, I think because I've a passion for nature and the environment and same with this sewing my own clothes, it's like slowing everything down and this idea of everything should not be disposable, you know, when people are like, oh, just get rid of it, you know, like kind of attitude that everyone has instead of trying to fix it or, you know, or just throw that out instead of trying to find someone else who could use it. So yeah, sort of like pushing back against that. And then I try to get as creative as I can within that. So like I've printed a bunch of my own fabric even because I'm also a printmaker and so have done like different processes like lithography and like screen printing and, you know, different ways to print your own fabric. And
what was the one you did with the leaves in the sun?
Those are cyanotypes.
Yeah.
Cyanotypes. A lot of people know them as blueprints. So yeah. And sort of like those are alternative process photography, you know, like something I got really into for a while and realized like, oh, you can do that with fabric. And so I can make my clothes, you know, from fabric that I've printed in the sun and, you know, use my photography and my sewing together and that kind of thing. So yeah, it doesn't have to be this like sort of boring thing to like do things that make you feel good and, you know, are good for the planet and good for people because sweatshops are gross.
Sure. And landfills are gross too. Yep. Yeah. Where our clothes end up. So what got you into sewing in the first place?
Again, we go way, way back with the sewing, like really when I think back to it. So I used to spend summers in Mexico and my cousins they did folkloric dance. And their mom, she would sew all their costumes for them. So I would spend a lot of time kind of like watching her sew all the costumes. And sometimes she'd give me like little extra pieces of fabric, like leftover, and I'd make like little Barbie clothes, you know, and that kind of thing. So it's interesting because a lot of things that people like pursue as their sort of like full-time passion, for me, I'm like, oh, this is like a skill I should add to my tool belt. And, you know, and now I know myself enough to know that anytime I try anything, I generally love it, you know? So I stop kind of trying some things. I there's not enough time. There's not enough of me to do things. You know, I will say the only thing I can think of that I've tried that I don't enjoy is calligraphy, which surprises me.
That surprises me too.
Right? I know. I was like, I remember going, I went into this workshop. This is total tangent, but I went to this workshop and I remember like we sat down and it was like, I was with a group of strangers and everyone's like, oh, I'm going to be so bad at this. And you know, they're kind of like self-deprecating. And I was like, I think I'm going to be amazing. And I'm like, they're like, okay. And I'm doing it. I'm like, this is so hard. It was not fun. And I was like, okay, well, I'll cross it off the list. Like at least there's one thing on the list of things that I do not like and can never be good at. But yeah, so back to sewing, then when I was in high school, we had sewing classes, clothing classes, and I was like, I feel like I should learn how to sew as a skill, you know, that I have. And I did it and I just got really into it. And then, you know, took some classes in college with sewing and I just kept doing it. And for a while, I wasn't doing it too much, but, you know, I would like make some costumes for like my films, you know, like I made like a short about Mexican wrestling. And so I needed a bunch of capes. And so I made a bunch of capes for that. And then eventually I just started making most of my own clothing. So like dresses and that kind of thing. And, you know, just to make things that I wasn't, because part of it too was like, I was like, I can't find this at the store, this like amazing fabric the way I want it. And so I could just make it myself. But yeah, that one also started way back if I think about it.
And once you started making your own clothes, how did your perspective shift when you would see like the Old Navy ad that says like stock up, buy a million t-shirts, things like that? Did it make you cringe a little more or see it a little differently?
Yeah. I mean, those ads make me cringe. And these, like those videos, I don't ever watch them, but I heard about the videos where people like buy a bunch of stuff and then unveil it, you know, on a video on YouTube. And people like, look at this amazing bargain that I got. And it's like, they're never going to wear it. They're going to throw it out with the tags on. One article that I read, someone saw this woman who had like these bags of clothing from like Zara or some equivalent to that at H&M, whatever. And it started raining and her bags got heavy because they got soaked. She literally just left the bags there and walked away.
Wow. Like,
that's how little value they have. And then I think about, you know, to her, it has little value because of the monetary value, you know, like, oh, I don't care. I just spent like $100 or whatever, however much she spent. But then I think about, okay, well, what about the waterways that were polluted from the dye and the fabric? What about, you know, the women, possibly children, who sewed those clothings under terrible conditions for pennies on the hour? So I think about the planet and the people behind those things. And it's just so gross. Like, and it's something that, you know, came about because like after World War II, people needed to buy more stuff to justify the bigger workforce that they had after people came back from the war. And so they had to create a demand for more clothing. But before then, like, you know, a long time ago, it was average women had maybe 6 dresses. And that was like their entire wardrobe, yeah. You know? So the idea now that, oh, you're never supposed to be seen wearing the same thing twice or whatever. Like when people go to weddings and they're like, well, I can't wear the same dress that I wore. And I'm like, that is just absolutely bananas to me that you can't be seen in the same dress. Like, is it going to make you dance less or like have
have a less time? Awesome time?
Yeah. Like, I'm just like, you can do the chicken in that same dress, even though you sweated in it before, like just get it clean. No big deal. So yeah, it like, I mean, that really kind of all of that just like bums me out, you know? And so for me, it's like, I wear my clothing until it dies because, you know, I'm just like, man, I put a lot of effort into this, you know, and you just have a stronger connection to it as well. And it just makes like every piece that I make is special in its own way, kind of has its own like personality, and you know, like I have to be in the right mood to wear whatever thing that I'm wearing. And I'm teaching artists sometimes, and there have been Miss Frizzle comparisons have been made towards me, which I do not mind at all. You know, I wish I had a magic school bus, but yeah. So the kids are drawn to it, and people are kind of drawn to you. But it is kind of funny because I do feel like my wardrobe is that of an extrovert and I'm an introvert. So it does kind of, there are times when I'm just like, I just don't want to talk to anyone. And people are coming up to you and like, hey, where'd you get that? You know, they want to talk about it. But yeah, overall it's a positive, and yeah. And I feel good, and trying to learn a little bit more about the nuances. It's like, you know, even if you sew your own clothing, like, how do you become less of a consumer? And, you know, how do you like source your fabrics in a more sustainable way, and kind of getting into that nitty gritty. So it's always cool when I find fabric at like a thrift store, and then I make something out of that. And I'm like, oh man, like I rescued this fabric from being thrown out, you know, and now I've made something with it that I love. And when people see it, they're like, wow, where did you get that dress? And it's like, well, kind of got it from the garbage, sort of, you know, like, and like my sister, she'll make jokes about, like, I remember one time she's like, oh, how'd you make that dress? Did you cut up your curtains? You know, like making like a Cinderella kind of joke.
Scarlett O'Hara thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm like, actually, yes, I did do that. I've done that before. It's like, I had this fabric that I was using for curtains and I didn't want it as curtains anymore. And I was like, you know what? That'd make a good dress. And I made a dress out of it. So, you know, sometimes I do that too, or like bathroom curtains and things like that.
Did you ever read a book called Threadbare Clothes, Sex and Trafficking by Anne Elizabeth?
Oh.
It's a really good book, but it touches on a lot of these issues and kind of makes the case that one of the best industries that could possibly tackle the wage gap is the fashion, is the garment industry, because of how many women are employed by it around the world. It's really an interesting book.
That is interesting. And, you know, like the thing is, everything in our lives, pretty much everything, keeps getting more and more expensive. And clothes is actually one of the very few industries where the main product has gotten cheaper over time. We should question that. Like, why are these clothes so cheap?
Right. I feel like with clothes and food, we should question, why is it so cheap? Like, what got subsidized and what garbage went into making, like what terrible practice happened? And yeah, definitely. I mean, I remember my grandmother, she made all of her own clothes. And when she, for her to tell the story of when she married my grandfather, she said, I put on my favorite dress and we just went to get married.
Like,
you know, you didn't really go buy a wedding dress per se. You just like wore your nicest thing. And she used to make her clothes out of flower sacks. That was the fabric she had access to.
I love that. Yeah. That's the thing, is they used to, people used to pick out their flower based on the pattern. Like when it was time to make a new dress, like you'd go to the groceries or wherever you bought your flower from, you know, and like you pick out the prettiest sack because that's what you were going to have your dress made out of. And yeah. And I think even for a time too, it was like this idea of like, even if you bought a dress for your wedding, you wore it after to formal occasions, you know, and now it's become this thing of like, you only wear it once. And that, like, some people spend tens of thousands of dollars on this article of clothing that they will never wear again. And that is just like, totally baffles me. And most people don't have their clothes custom made. And you have this custom made article of clothing that's just disposable, that you'll just never use again, that you spent so much money on. Like, they should be making wedding dresses so that, sure, you want to have your pretty white wedding dress, you can, but maybe like you can dye it afterwards and you can shorten it and all of a sudden it's a formal dress. Like there's different creative ways on how to like reuse it, but I feel like that's also kind of wasteful because then you're wasting all the work that went into making that dress that fit you perfectly.
It's as if there's this embodied energy that's in every piece of clothing of like how much effort and how many resources went into creating it and getting
exactly.
it to you. Yeah.
And
exactly. I mean, you mentioned custom. I think that's the other part that's so interesting. There is an Erica dress. There is the dress that I feel like you have in several different fabrics of this particular cut. And it's this perfect dress for you because you're able to make it this perfect thing that fits you exactly like you want it to.
Yeah. And I'll kind of do like variations, and I'll be like, oh, I'll try like a different silhouette, but I'm never like as happy with it, you know, and there are some of them that, you know, just like feel better on. And then there are some that, like, I always try to make my dresses so that I can also like alter them depending on like weight loss or gain. Cause that's the other thing too, is like people like, oh, this doesn't fit me. And you should wear, everybody should wear clothes that fit them. There should never be like, I know some people are like, I don't want to wear this cause I got to lose 10 pounds before, you know, or I'm going to buy this because I am going to lose 10 pounds or whatever. But you should wear clothes that feel good and that fit you right. Because of course you're not going to be comfortable in your current weight if the clothes don't fit you properly. Then clothes should also be made so that they can be altered to allow for being a human, you know, and they used to be that way. Like they used to have like really, you know, like extra fabric sewn in the seams of the dresses so that you could make it bigger if you needed to, right? And so like I'll do that, like I'll make my clothes bigger and smaller accordingly, you know, pandemic weight, whatever, like no problem. Just made it bigger. So yeah, I think that's the other thing too, is like when you talk about like the Erica dress, like I've had a couple people kind of criticize that part. They'll be like, oh, I feel like I see you in that all the time, whatever. But it's also this idea of like, oh, you have to have a totally different look every time. Like it's so bizarre to me because I'm like, why wouldn't I go with the thing that I like the most? You know, like, why wouldn't that be what I wear the most? And also, it's interesting to me, that aspect of it too, because maybe it's just because I'm like not observant enough, but I very rarely notice people's clothing. Very rarely do. So it's always surprising to me when someone who I don't know very well would comment on like, oh, well, you're wearing that again. And I'm like, this is my second time talking to you. How do you even know, you know,
why are you thinking of that? Yeah.
Yeah. Like it makes sense that like a friend of mine who I see all the time, like you would say it, but not somebody who I'm like, oh, I just met you and you're already comment. Like it's bizarre. So, but again, I think it goes back to that idea of like, why is that a negative thing of like, oh, I found this thing that I like and I'm going to keep wearing it.
Right. Cause really the argument is, how dare you not uphold consumerism,
yeah,
and constantly change your clothing silhouette and constantly be buying new clothing to uphold capitalism and consumerism and to give my eyes variety who I am not you. Like that's really what you're saying, as if we owe people this variety of looks on ourselves, which is ridiculous, because you're essentially saying to someone, how dare you find the thing that you are comfortable in, feel confident in, and feel flattered by, and how dare you wear it more than once? which is really bananas when you really start to kind of unpack it.
Yeah, it's happened to me several times now. And so I feel like I should have some kind of response to it, but it just never fails to baffle me, you know? And like, I could, you know, and that sort of like, you know, introverted, I'm going to replay everything in my head a million times, ruminating sort of way. I always think of like, oh, well, I should have said this, you know? And there've been a couple of times where I'll make a comment like, oh, well, yeah, you know, but like a little kid didn't make this, you know, like whatever kind of like comment I'm going to make them feel guilty for their comment. But just the idea that, yeah, that it bothers them is just so, I'm like, there are so many things you should actually be bothered by, you know, my chosen silhouette should be at the absolute bottom of the list, like very, very bottom. It's funny because even people who've made those comments, like I can't even remember what they were wearing or how they dress, like, and if I picture them, you know, like I have no idea what that person wears. And so the fact that they even noticed is bizarre to me. And the fact that they've were bothered by it enough to comment on it is bizarre to me.
But I think, I mean, part of it is like probably a bigger thing to unpack about a sense of entitlement about women's bodies and yeah, appearance, and that we have to fit into a certain definition of looking a certain way as like the rent we pay to be on the planet.
Yeah.
And how dare we deviate from it, really?
Yeah, definitely. And the fact that unfortunately, as much as women are hurt by this, that we're often the ones like upholding it.
Right. Absolutely.
That's so tragic.
Remember that whole thing? I think it was an Australian morning TV show. As an experiment, the male host wore the same suit every day for a very long time. I don't know if it was a month or a year maybe, but it was a long time. And, you know, the woman would wear the same color twice in a week and they'd be like, oh, well, she's given up on life because she wore a blue dress twice. And nobody noticed, not one person noticed that the man wore the same suit for this. I want to say it was a year, but it was a very long time, and not one person noticed that he was wearing the same thing every day.
I don't remember that, but I do remember like Obama making a comment one time, like how he wore the same tux to every single formal event and no one ever noticed. And he's like, you know, Michelle has to change her dress every single time. And, you know, obviously there was a big, he had a big scandal with the tan suit. Let's not,
sure,
that let's was not, you know, dredge that up. but apart from the tan suit, and it wasn't because he had worn it before, you know, obviously, but yeah, he wore the same tux to every single formal event and nobody noticed, commented, no, you know, nothing. But if Michelle, I'm sure if Michelle had worn, Michelle Obama had worn the same dress twice, it, you know, uproar. Yeah.
Well, and Obama also, I feel like he at one point commented on, if there's a shirt that I like that I feel is comfortable and flattering, I'll buy it in every color. It's one less decision I have to make. So he kind of had a system about it, which everyone was like, wow, what a thinker, you do it. And everybody's like, wow, she's not really upholding this hyper-consumerist thing. I mean, to me, I think the Erica dress is like a point of branding because it's a statement, that it's a political statement that you make every time you leave the house of, I am opting out of this system that hurts people around the world, that hurts the planet and uses resources. And it may be made out of fabric that has comic books on it, or it may be made out of like fabric I made. And I think that it feels like a political statement every time you do it, but it also, to me, reads like a point of confidence because of exactly what you said. I know the dress that I feel amazing in that fits me right. And I'm going to go take on the world in it. It feels very political to me, the Erica dress.
That's cool. Yeah, I mean, I guess all that thought is put into it, but not on a daily basis. So to me, it's just getting dressed. And it's funny because, yeah, people, because it's a dress, people also comment like, oh, you're so fancy, you're a fancy lady, blah, blah, blah. And to me, I'm like, okay, I took 3 minutes to get dressed this morning, you know, like, or however long, like, to, you know, like very, very short amount of time. And I'm sure the people who are wearing their quote unquote casual jeans, you know, and the t-shirt probably took longer to like pick out their outfit or whatever, you know, because they're separates. Separates always take longer. But, you know, for me, it's like, it's everything we've discussed, but it's also, yeah, like Obama says, like one less decision I need to think about in the morning. I don't want to occupy my brain space with like, oh, what am I wearing? You know, like if I know I'm comfortable in all the things that I have, then I could just pick out whatever and it doesn't matter.
And you can use that brain space to make other films.
Exactly. Full circle.
Nice. I think that's a good place to stop right there. Yeah. Boom. Nice. Boom. Nailed it. Well, I'm so glad that your brother wanted you to be a Coke dealer when you were 8, because it is clearly paying off in wonderful ways.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Erica. I super appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you, Amy. This has been fun.
Thank you for listening to Finding Favorites with Leah Jones. Please make sure to subscribe and drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Now, go out and enjoy your favorite things.